Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
don't you know? News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Jason, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, March 20th, 2014. First day of spring. Happy spring, everybody. And here are some of the headlines we'll be talking about and looking at today. We're going to start off with some Obamacare. A few different articles that we've dug up, including a particularly poignant one that we're going to start off with. Then we're going to get into the NSA and the latest nonsense there, including a rather interesting speech given by Senator Rand Paul at, of all places, Berkeley, the liberal bastion. We're going to report that he actually got a standing ovation there. Can you believe that? And if we can get to it, we'll talk about some monetary policy stuff as well. But we're going to start off the hour with a report that comes out of a relatively obscure online publication, GuardianLV.com, but it actually cites Associated Press data, and I'll read it to you. The headline says, Obamacare denied at most cancer hospitals. Obamacare is denied at most cancer hospitals. According to a recent Associated Press survey, only 4 out of 19 of the nation's best cancer hospitals who replied to the survey said they will accept patients' insurance from all the healthcare exchanges within their state, in effect, excluding most people who are signing up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, commonly referred to as Obamacare. The Obama administration designed the healthcare plans under the Affordable Care Act essentially as a no-frills, bare-bones HMO. Faced with low profit margins as a result of these HMOs, insurance companies are limiting the number of doctors and hospitals within a given healthcare network. The insurance companies have also vastly reduced what they will cover outside the network. Bill, this is perhaps not the best news for the Obama administration, although curiously enough, it's not getting a lot of play. You would think that something like cancer, which of course is one of those high levels of healthcare expense that supposedly motivated people in Congress to provide health care for everybody, you would think that would be a particular concern to them. But if the word's not getting out, maybe they aren't going to be held accountable.
Well, listeners might not be familiar with some of the terminology, just for reference. HMO is a health maintenance organization,
right,
and you are assigned to a particular set or network of doctors and hospitals and so on. And that's pretty much all of that the insurance covers is just those specific people. The variation of that is called a PPO, which is a preferred provider organization. So they put you in a network and they pay whatever, you know, benefits that they do, but they allow you to go outside the network and still give you benefits from the insurance policy. So it's interesting that they're characterizing Obamacare as an HMO program, bare bones HMO, which really hasn't been, you know, discussed at length as to what the insurance policies are that are being offered. Well, what qualifies under Obamacare regulations? So if it is in fact an HMO situation, then it isn't surprising that other facilities and other treatments are not covered by the insurance program, whether it's cancer or diabetes. We were talking last week about, I think it was diabetes. The premium drug that might be prescribed by one physician costs thousands of dollars more per pill than the standard treatment that that most physicians offer for diabetics. So it's going to be interesting as this develops, because as we've mentioned multiple times, with this kind of program, the only way to reduce the cost, the overall insurance cost, which is what provide, you know, it's supposed to be the Affordable Care Act, and the only way they can do that is by either restricting access or by actual rationing, saying you can't have this treatment even though it's the best treatment for you. You have to accept this other treatment because that's what complies with Obamacare. In other words, seeking out the minimum instead of the maximum service from healthcare providers.
And of course, when you aim at the minimum, you can pretty much guarantee that that minimum will reduce over time until it becomes so minimum and so minimal that it's almost non-existent. Basically, the same concept as the lowest common denominator.
Well, the other thing that happens is the insurance companies will restrict their network of providers to a much smaller number. And therefore, when you go to a doctor, rather than being one of 20 patients in the waiting room, you'd be one of 100.
Yeah.
And that's an indirect way of rationing treatment, is it just becomes so frustrating to see a doctor that most people won't go. They'll, go to their local drugstore and find whatever they can.
But still, it's very disconcerting. 4 out of 19 cancer hospitals, the best cancer hospitals, would accept Obamacare. The other 15 would not. That's I don't care how you slice it, that's embarrassing to the Obama administration and to the supporters of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, the other thing that is rarely discussed, which was also in the article, the new plans that are being offered, previous to Obamacare, people with cancer were limited to a copay of $50 to $90 a month for cancer drugs. And now under the new plans, they have to pay out up to $2,500 a month out of pocket for those cancer drugs. So, oops. Again, that's another way that, I hate to call it a scam because that's kind of a cynic's viewpoint, but all of these things are necessary in order for Obamacare to avoid totally wiping out the federal budget.
Not just wiping out the federal budget, but it's going to reach the point, and we aren't there yet because they haven't dealt with the employer mandate, but it's going to reach the point where it wipes out the average family of four budget, or a family of two or three or five or whatever else, because current rate that they're starting out with are going to be far in excess of what your average family can reasonably afford.
Right, but objective of Obamacare was that you get as many healthy people, normally younger people who don't have any illness and probably don't anticipate any significant injuries, to get into the insurance pool so that the elder sickly people don't have to pay as much because of being subsidized.
But what we're seeing is that it's actually more than that. It isn't just getting them into the pool. It's also soaking those who are already in the pool but are healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, because when your minimum plan, you got the three metal plans, the bronze, the silver, and the gold. When the bronze plan, which basically has almost no coverage at all, huge high deductibles, and essentially doubles the premiums or more of everyone who had high deductible plans before in order to help cover the extra expense, when the bare minimum plan ends up costing you a minimum of $12,000 a year or whatever, we're talking a significant chunk out of people's budgets. I mean, last week you made the part of the article about the claim that Obama said younger people should not be complaining, that they should be, reassessing their priorities and not spending so much on cell phones and taking on health care. Well, what he failed to acknowledge and to address is the fact that the rates that are involved for young people are low compared to what happens with, say, people who are in their 30s or 40s or 50s, because for that group, I mean, the rates have become absolutely outrageous. It is literally now impossible to buy low-cost insurance. Can't be done anymore unless you are under the guidelines where they're going to subsidize you. But even then, the rates that you're paying for insurance are still high. It's just that they're not coming out of your pocket. They're coming out of your neighbor's pocket.
Yeah, and the other thing that's happening in Obamacare that people didn't realize until after it was passed is that they've restricted the insurance companies to three brackets, this gold, silver, bronze.
Right.
Now, it used to be that an insurance company with a smart actuary that was, on top of things, your rate and your policy would be determined not just by your own personal preferences, but by your zip code, by your age, by your, pre-existing conditions, by a whole variety of different characteristics that have an influence, like your weight and so on and so forth, so that they would have, hundreds of different policy rates for different people. It was all individualized down to the zip code range.
Right.
Well, now it's strictly by county and strictly three categories, and the top category can't be more than 30% higher than the middle one, and the middle one can't be more than 30% higher than the lowest one. And then you have the hidden one, which is not gold, silver, or bronze, but aluminum or whatever they call it, that is the catastrophic
plastic
insurance. It's just like buying liability for your car insurance, where it covers almost nothing and it costs very little.
By the way, something else we haven't really touched on, but if you actually go through the process, now that they actually have their websites working, if you actually go through the process of applying, it turns out you can't find out what your rates are going to be until after you apply.
Right.
Which is really bizarre. I mean,
well,
the normal order of things is that you apply for something after you found out what the rates are and decide what you want to apply for. But no, you have to actually apply for Obamacare first before you're even allowed to find out what the rates are. Then you get to decide which ones you're going to buy, if you're going to buy one at all, which is really backwards.
And not only that, but even though there is on the federal website, there is a database of all the doctors that qualify in a particular network for all these different insurance policies, they will not tell you. You cannot go and look up, you know, Dr. John Jones and find out which policy he's going to be covered by. They will not tell you that.
Well, it depends on in certain states you can. I know in Connecticut I was able to do that today, so Connecticut has actually tied that in. But you may be right about the national site. I haven't checked that in the last month or so.
Yeah, it's until after you buy the policy, you don't really know what all the different deductibles are for different treatments, and you don't really know what the network is, you know, which doctors are covered and which ones not. And again, it does vary from state to state for those states that, you know, decided to set up their own state exchanges. Although
right.
Some of them, you should be happy you went to Connecticut instead of Massachusetts.
Yeah, Massachusetts is kind of in a state, aren't they?
Well, it's ironic because, of course, the Massachusetts health care plan was the Romney plan that Obama said that he used as the basis for the federal program. But the Massachusetts site has been broken for the past year, and it won't be functional until this fall. Although they're bragging about the success of the Massachusetts program, people in Massachusetts cannot use an online exchange to buy their policies. They have to go to an office, fill out the paperwork manually, and then the state processes the application as they normally would.
Absolute insanity. There's no other way to describe it. Something that we picked up a few weeks back, unions are they're complaining, like, well, almost every employer is complaining about, but unions are also complaining about, and in fact, they were asking for an exemption under the ACA for their own health care plans, which I thought was fascinating because they were the ones who helped get Obama elected in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, and they supported the ACA legislation, but it's interesting because there's a totally separate category. Last October, all of the individual policies went kafunket, and you got canceled, and you had to buy it on the exchange. That was only 5% of all the insurance policies. Probably 80 or 90% of the policies are employer policies. And those don't go gafunkata until October 1st of this year, just prior to the election. But then there's a remainder of 10 to 15% that are not employer and they are not individual. They are organizational health plans. And the most common organizational health plans are those that are set up by unions. And they've been kind of derided by Obama and the administration as gold-plated programs. Mm-hmm. Because the unions get, you know, all these beautiful benefits for an extremely low price, because it's going through their union, they get a special price for the gold-plated plan if they don't buy it through the Obamacare exchange. So I'm not sure when that set of policies goes kafunkata. That's a word that just happens to fall off my tongue. But the unions are upset because what they're looking at is that the amount that they have to pay, the amount the union members have to pay, is restricted by Obamacare. And for most of them, their premiums are going to go up, you know, $5, $10, $20, $100%, over the course of this implementation. So what they're saying is, and I think this is an independent organization that did a survey of these particular programs and said that without the smart fixes for the unions, the ACA threatens the middle class with higher premiums, loss of hours, a shift to part-time work, and less comprehensive coverage because they are going to be impacted by Obamacare.
Now, of course, most people have not yet actually felt the impact of Obamacare on their own health care and on their own pocketbooks, mainly because most people, or at least a large majority of the people, shall we say, get their health care through their employers. And those employer mandates, of course, have been postponed for at least a year. Was it 2 years now? I'm not sure exactly how far out it is. So the bottom line is that there's only a relatively small minority of the overall population who are impacted by it. But it does raise the question, what do you think? Is there any likelihood that we're going to see some relief for that minority, or are we just going to see delays for the majority going forward, or how do you think that's going to play out?
Well, theoretically, as of October 1st this year, all of the employer-based health insurance programs die. They just go out of existence if they don't comply with Obamacare. And so we're going to have this coming October 1st, a new section of the Obamacare exchanges for both federal and state that deal with employer-provided health care. Now, the funny thing is that as of a month or two ago, they hadn't yet programmed that section of the website. And because it requires the intervention of each individual employer that offers medical insurance. What happens is it isn't the employees that choose. The employer talks to a variety of different insurance companies and says, what can you offer? What's the price? How much is it going to cost us? How much is it going to cost the employees? And they pick out the top three. And then that's what they offer to their employees. Now, what's going to happen October 1st is that the employers are going to pick, you know, whatever plans that they think are appropriate for them. And all of a sudden, employees are going to get a little letter in the mail or in their message box saying, here are the new plans. Your previous plan is no longer active, and as of the end of the year, it's going to be canceled, and here are your new choices.
Right. But for certain companies, particularly companies with 100 workers or more, they actually get a postponement on this, don't they? I believe they've been given a one-year grace period on it.
It is and it isn't. Here's the thing. The administration is trying as best they can to make the changes as small as possible. And the only way they can legally do that is by saying, we are not going to prosecute. If you have an insurance policy that doesn't comply with Obamacare, we're just going to assume that it does for the next year. And you're going to get all the IRS credits. And this is a big problem because the IRS can't possibly enforce the mandates unless they have all the detailed information about what kind of care you have, what kind of policy you have, whether it qualifies for a subsidy or not. And as of the end of this year, the IRS is going to have to start sending out money in advances on tax credits, both to employers and to employees. Well, they can't possibly do the enforcement necessary to actually make sure that all these policies comply with Obamacare. So what the administration does was said, hey, you know, we're not going to enforce, you know, the Obamacare provisions on your policy for another year, which probably means until March 31st of next year. So it's an interesting attempt to make something workable that isn't really workable.
At all. Yeah, it's very unworkable. And unfortunately, it'll probably continue to be unworkable, but that's for them to deal with. Fortunately, you and I, we're dealing with it. We probably come up with an entirely different solution than what they have on the table. But
no. Well, we've been through the history before of medical insurance and how it ended up being a third-party payer program, which was basically Richard Nixon. When President Nixon imposed wage and price controls way back when, the administration decided that even though they were freezing wages, they weren't going to count any benefits that were added on to employee salaries for medical purposes. So that's why all of the employee medical insurance programs are deducted from your wages. You don't pay any taxes on those benefits. And as a consequence of that policy from decades ago, almost everybody has been transitioning into an employer-based program, which is beneficial for the corporations, too, because they can write off all those expenses as raw personnel expenses from their bottom line. And so it's beneficial for them, it's beneficial for the individual taxpayer, but because of the intervention, everybody has been forced into an employer program. And that introduces all kinds of complications in terms of what options you have, who's responsible for making the medical decisions, who pays and who doesn't.
Well, it's been beneficial to the corporations up until now. I'm not so sure it's going to hold that way.
Well, given that the administration, as a matter of fact, there was just an announcement yesterday or today. I thought the number was 85%. The insurance companies were required to pay 85% of their income in benefits. But in fact, somewhere along the way, that got amended, and it's actually 80%. So the insurance companies are guaranteed 20% for administrative purposes, profits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the Sebelius came out yesterday or today and said, oh, we're going to adjust that. Now they only have to spend 78 or 77.5% of their premiums on actual health services. Now, that's not allowed by the law, but it's supposed to be some kind of administrative discretion. So basically they're saying, hey, yeah, okay, insurance companies, we know you're going to increase the rates and everything else, and we're also going to make sure that you're not going to suffer as a consequence of the low enrollment and the low number of young people that are signing up, and we'll guarantee that you get 22.5% to play with for your profit. But that's not the case with employers. So it'll be interesting to see how it impacts on employers.
Yeah, that's the thing. The corporate employers, I think, are the ones who are going to get hit. And when they get hit, I think they're going to push back. And the pushback, my guess, the pushback happens in two ways. First pushback comes to the government. They keep pushing the government to try to get something changed. And when they can't, then they push back by handing the cost off to the employees. Now, I could be wrong about that, but that's my impression of how they'll do it, because I don't think they're going to eat the costs themselves.
Well, I mean, politically, they want to push as much of the cost onto employees as they can, so that the employees write to their congressman or whatever and say, this Obamacare is killing me. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's really lousy timing as far as the election is concerned to have employer programs suddenly changing on October 1st when people are going to be voting 2 months later or a month later.
Yeah, they're trying very hard to shield the electorate from the realities of the program, but we'll have to see just how effective they are doing that.
Now, I'm sure every Democrat who is up for election in 2012, which includes all of Congress and a fairly large number of senators, are pushing the administration to make all these accommodations and exceptions and transitional programs and so on to soften the blow that is obvious, because 60 to 80% of people don't like Obamacare, and they're unhappy with it, and they are discovering all kinds of terrible things that are going to result, whether it's losing their doctor, or losing their cancer treatment, or whatever it is.
Which is going to, ironically, create an opportunity for the Republicans, who really haven't done what they have to do in order to make their party more, what shall we say, attractive to the electorate. Except for one. There's one Republican who is at least making some effort in that range. That would be Senator Rand Paul, who he seems to be the one Republican who gets it, that the Republican Party can't stay the way they are and expect to keep winning elections because it isn't going to happen. And he's trying to make some waves and get the Republican Party to change a bit. At least that's what his stated goal is. I'm not sure how serious he is about it. Although it is interesting to note that he made an appearance at a liberal bastion this past week at Berkeley, California. He delivered a speech and got a standing ovation for it, which is really quite an interesting thing.
Well, because he limited his speech to a theme that liberals generally are delighted with, and that is personal privacy. He was talking about the NSA and talking about forming a church commission and to set up a group of watchers to watch the watchers, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Rand has got some good advisors on his putative campaign, presumptive campaign for president, because one of the first places he spoke to was, I'm trying to remember the name of the black college in the South. And he went down and addressed them and got standing ovations because he was talking about individual liberty and talking about how government programs damage different ethnic groups more than others. And I think his main theme was the drug laws, how they seriously impact the black community and the Latino community. And so he finds an issue that's appropriate for a group, no matter what group it is, and gets standing applause. So that's encouraging. He's trying to broaden the tent by saying, hey, these are important issues, these are important positions, and whether he's ranting against drones or ranting against the NSA or ranting against drug laws, he's pulling in people from unlikely groups that are looking at supporting him.
Interesting. You mentioned the drones too, because he got a lot of kudos from the left in particular for his filibuster that he performed last spring, I think it was, against the whole concept of drones, particularly here in the United States, and the question of whether or not they'd ever be used against American citizens.
Well, so, there's an interesting comparison between Rand Paul and Justin Amash, who is a congressman from Michigan, who is very libertarian. And he sponsored a bill to basically shut down the NSA. And the Democrats and a fairly large number of Republicans were terribly upset with the fact that he had bipartisan sponsorship. Like 100 congressmen, 50 of them Democrats, 50 of them Republicans, in favor of this bill. And they were able to force it to the floor for a vote, and it almost passed. Within just a few votes, and it was a radical bill to totally, eliminate all of the NSA bulk data collection and so on. So those are just two examples of maybe a half dozen different congressmen and senators who are trying to reach out and trying to find people that are willing to ignore the R and actually vote for a Republican, even though he's not taking really party establishment stances on a variety of different issues.
You really love that story, don't you, the Amash bill? I mean, I got to start keeping records of it, but I would be willing to bet you mentioned it at least 15 times this year.
No, twice maybe. Well, Justin is one of my favorites. I mean, he's the only congressman in the whole Congress who actually posts on Facebook his reason for every single vote that he makes. Literally.
That's pretty unusual.
Even approving the roll call. So if you go to Justin Amash and you like his Facebook site, you will get every day like two or three emails saying, here's why I voted for this, and here's the principle involved, and here's the exception, and here is the circumstances, and therefore I voted yes or no, whatever it was.
Well, listen, we're halfway through the show. Let's take a break, and then after the break, let's continue on with the discussion about the NSA. Well, in fact, we'll also look at what Rand Paul's father had to say about it and the latest revelations about the Mystic Archive, which you may not have heard about, but you'll hear about it here. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I guess we're back.
One commercial break there.
We're going to have to sync this a little bit with our engineer next time. That's okay. Yeah, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And before the break, we were talking about Rand Paul and how he got a great reaction on his speech regarding privacy rights and the NSA. But the NSA itself has continued to be in the news, not so much in the news on a major way on the major media sites, but the revelations keep on coming. And the latest one regards something called Mystic. And I don't think, Bill, they're talking about Mystic, Connecticut.
Well, this is, you know, something we talked about with Charles Fattis a long time ago. They come up with these weird names for things. Not only did they pick Mystic for this particular program, but they have a wizard with a wand, and on the end of the wand is his cell phone. And this is a program they started in 2009, which is intended to collect every single phone conversation nationwide in a foreign country, storing billions of them in a 30-day rolling buffer that clears the oldest calls when the new ones come in. And they apparently are using this on several companies, although the Snowden documents don't indicate which ones, or they've, you know, blotted it out, or haven't said. But this kind of ties in with my speculation a week or two ago that the NSA isn't collecting the content of phone calls in the U.S. It is letting the British intelligence collect all the U.S. content. They are collecting all the British content. And so they each, neither one of them are violating their own laws because it's a foreign country, so they can go through all of the British conversations and do their extraction, which seems to be what this Mystic program is supposed to do, retrospective retrieval, retro program tool, whatever it is. And it's probably likely that the British, who is, you know, one of the Five Eyes, has access to all the U.S. communications. The NSA doesn't look at it. They just ship it off to Britain. When Britain finds something interesting, they say, hey, check out this number. So I suspect that's what's happening, but I don't know that it's going to be necessarily in the Snowden documents about how much actual sharing there is of which kind of data among the two countries, or, for that matter, how much spying the U.S. is doing on Germany or France or Spain or Italy or anybody else.
No, perhaps not. But one thing we do know is that the politicians in the leading Western countries are becoming a little bit unnerved, shall we say, about the extent to which the intelligence communities are doing spying that they themselves don't even know about, including spying on themselves.
Yeah. Well, I should have picked out this article because I'm just remembering off the top of my head. But there was one of the documents, or maybe somebody who was a whistleblower, separate from the Snowden documents, who was explaining that the NSA and the various intelligence agencies didn't have to worry about any changes in political policy, any elections, or anything like that, because they were an isolated, self-sustaining institution within the government, and that they didn't have to tell politicians anything about what they were doing, or just give them cursory summaries of what they were doing. And so they would be able to preserve all of their programs either by just changing the name of it, you know, making slight modifications, telling fables to the various courts that are supposed to be supervising it, giving legislators you know, a one-hour window to look through 30,000 documents and things like that. So they aren't really worried about the politicians. And that seems to be the case in Britain and Germany and France. When the Snowden revelations came out, almost all of the political representatives, including most of the members of the intelligence committees in the U.S., said, we had no idea. We had no idea that this was going on. And, you know, NSA constantly claims that they have congressional oversight, But I've heard commentaries from various senators and representatives who said, yeah, I got a notice on Friday evening at 6:30 p.m. that I could look at NSA documents tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., but staff were not allowed, and I'd only have an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was what constituted congressional oversight. You know, it's just becoming evident that the politicians don't have a clue. There are nobody watching the watchers. And those that think they are being sorely disappointed, like Dianne Feinstein, who discovered not only are they listening to the 37 million people in California, but they're listening to our staff in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. My God, that's terrible. It's against the law. I need an apology, please.
And it's not just U.S. politicians. It's also British politicians, because this past week we learned that former British cabinet minister Chris Huhne noted that, quote, when it comes to the secret world of GCHQ and the NSA, the depth of my privileged information has been dwarfed by the information provided by Edward Snowden to The Guardian.
Yeah.
What a quote that is.
Yeah,
that summarizes in one sentence what you just described, that the intelligence communities have treated the politicians as if they only needed to know just whatever the intelligence community said they needed to know, and they didn't need to know anything more.
Well, not only that, but the intelligence committees, for a variety of political purposes, including the interest of their own reelection, have brought in people from the NSA to actually write legislation that governs the NSA. And they put on all kinds of catchphrases, like, we're not listening to any particular person's telephone conversations unless they are targeted. And the only reason they're targeted is because we have a reasonable suspicion that they might possibly be associated somehow with some kind of terrorist organization. So that when they wrote the laws, they wrote the NSA put in all this terminology, which they could fudge, and they interpreted it the way they damn well pleased. And in some cases, the FISA court, which is supposed to be the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, has said, wait a second, how can you possibly interpret this law to say this thing when it doesn't really say that thing? And that they've, batted down the NSA a little bit, totally in secret. And the NSA has come back and said, oh, okay, well, we're going to change our implementation of this, such and so, and that, so and so forth. So it's been, not surprisingly for, CIA, NSA types, an effort to, confuse and befuddle all the politicians and all of the administrators who are supposedly responsible for the legislation that passes Congress.
Well, apparently the FISA courts didn't blink when it came to spying on Congress, particularly on Feinstein's staff, which suggests that the FISA courts were perfectly fine with the claim that there was some reason to believe that there was terrorist activity emanating out of the staff of Dianne Feinstein.
Well,
personally, I'd like to know what led them to come to that conclusion.
Well, first of all, here's what the NSA says. The NSA says, well, we're doing this dragnet. We've got this bulk data that we're collecting. We have to collect it from everybody, including all the congressional staffers, including all the members of the House and the Senate, and maybe even some people in the administration. Otherwise, we don't have the haystack. We've got to get the haystack, whether you're associated with terrorism or not. Now, that refers to metadata. When it comes to the Feinstein incident, it was a case where the NSA had given her staff some information and some reports on the detention policies and interrogation policies, and then realized they didn't really want them to know about that. And they went into the computers in the staff offices and deleted hundreds of files. Now, that's a little bit different than collecting metadata from the phone company. They're actually either physically or electronically going into the Senate, chambers, computers, and deleting data. And that's what got Feinstein so irritated. So it is a little bit different than just, what's happening to the rest of
the
constituents.
My point is the FISA court didn't have any problem with it.
I haven't seen that it's actually come to a head. In terms of the FISA court, the FISA court has been still approving all of the requests from the NSA.
We don't get to see all the FISA approvals, obviously, because those are classified too. But it stands to reason they've been approving virtually everything. The number of things that they have disapproved apparently you can count on one hand. And I think we probably would have heard that this was one of them if it had ever been disapproved, and they haven't said that. So clearly they must have approved it. Just, you know,
well,
reasoning.
Somebody in the administration approved it. But how high up it went, or whether it was in the NSA or the Justice Department or the legal counsel, it's hard to tell.
Well, yeah, but even if the administration did approve it, the main thing is the FISA court still has to approve it. If they're going to do something without a warrant, FISA court has to approve it. That's what the law. That's what we're told. We're told that they approve. They get involved in every single situation where the NSA wants to get involved and do something without a warrant. That's supposedly what they're set up to do.
No.
I'm taking them at their word.
No. You misunderstand something. The FISA court is a court of one judge who rotates with a dozen other judges that sits in the NSA offices, and they get a request and they rubber stamp it.
Oh, I know that.
Now, the request
taking them at their word.
No, but the request...
Based on the only,
yeah, but the only requests that they're looking at are the requests for bulk collection of metadata, either by phones or internet. They're not looking at, you know, special activities like the NSA or the CIA going into Senate offices and deleting files. That's
why you don't know that, because none of us get to see what the court's actually doing. But second of all, I would think that when the FISA court judge hears about, for instance, the Dianne Feinstein situation, he probably gets a little bit ticked because that's something he would think would have to go past him. Either that or else he approved it, one or the other. I didn't hear anything about it being ticked, so I kind of assumed that he approved it.
Well, you have to understand that the FISA court only deals with, this is funny, the FISA law, as it's written, only allows the FBI to do this kind of bulk data collection metadata for domestic terrorist protection. FBI, you heard it right, not the NSA. So the FBI wrote a little letter to the NSA, and they said, well, we've been given this power under the FISA law, and we don't really have the resources to do it, so we're going to hand off all of our responsibilities and all of our powers to the NSA, without telling Congress.
Probably without telling the president.
Or the president, probably not. He has to have deniability after all.
Well, he's only the commander-in-chief. I mean, why should he know about it?
Well, he's busy with his resolution matrix, which is a list of terrorists he wants to kill. So he actually made the offhanded comment, I'm getting pretty good at killing people. Because
also,
he goes through the list and he checks this one, kill him, kill Zarqawi, kill this guy. And they send out drones and then blow them away.
Well, he's also a little busy trying to keep Obamacare going, but that's another story which we covered earlier.
No, he prefers sitting with his matrix. So somebody else, let Sebelius figure out this Obamacare stuff.
We mentioned Rand Paul before, but his father, Ron, of course, also has plenty to say about the NSA, and he said some more this past week. He was very concise about it. He said, we can't let this happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's Ron Paul has for years and years ranted against secret government powers, and his son has taken that up in a lot of cases, the fundamental principle is that there is no constitutional authorization and actually a Fourth Amendment restriction on what the government can take. And Ron Paul's interpretation, my interpretation, Rand Paul's interpretation, and even the ACLU's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment is that they can't be doing any of this bulk collection of data, whether it's content or just metadata. And that's the position. Now, there's a half dozen court cases that are making their way up to the Supreme Court, and hopefully somewhere along the way in the next few months, the court is going to actually be hearing arguments on and the Fourth Amendment violations that are inherent in the NSA collection. So that'll be an interesting development as it comes down.
And an even more humorous and more bizarre twist on the whole thing is that even Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook doesn't like it. Even he's against the whole idea.
Yeah, well, there was a suggestion along the way, I think it was from The Guardian, they had to retract the story, but they were saying that all of the different institutions, whether it was Facebook or Verizon or whoever it was, that all of these corporations knew what was happening. And the various corporations have sent out various, you know, messages saying, we don't approve of this, we comply with the law. And that law explicitly states they cannot talk about any of the demands that they've gotten from the NSA. Otherwise, they're breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't a question of that they know or don't know. It's a question of they never consented. They got actual court orders demanding this information. And so Zuckerberg is making the point that we're doing everything we can, not just against private malware and viruses and bugs and all this kind of stuff. We're going to do the best we can to give our users actual privacy and allow them to make choices about what becomes public and what doesn't. So he's saying, hey, you know, what the NSA is doing is not something I support, and I'm going to do whatever I can legally, you know, within the confines of the law, to prevent them from doing it.
You know, in the notes that you hand me each week, there was one particular note this week that kind of caught my attention. I was curious what it was all about. The note said that the House may ban NSA bulk data. What did you mean by that?
Well, what's happening is that both the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees have been reading all the Snowden information and saying they can't believe this is going on, and
yeah, right.
There have to be modifications to the law. So with events like the Feinberg Feinstein intervention and the latest reports about what the FISA court is objected to, the House and the Senate committees are actually on the verge of finalizing details to totally amend the FISA law, to eliminate the bulk collection altogether, to eliminate the NSA maintenance of this data and their targeting procedures and so on and so forth, and going to open up the operations of these various agencies to the regular court system. Instead of having a secret FISA court of one guy sitting in an office rubber stamping all this stuff, they're actually going to force the regular courts to review the policies that the NSA is implementing. Now that, there's going to be a lot of log rolling and compromise and trying to make everybody happy and so on and so forth. But Politico says that they're actually working on something that's going to severely restrict the NSA's discretion in terms of what it's capable of doing.
You know, call me skeptical and call me crazy, but even if they pass something like that,
skeptical and you're crazy.
I'll believe it when I see it.
I think it could happen. I think it could happen only because these politicians are actually reading the polls. They're actually reading a public opinion poll showing that 60 to 80% of the people, depending upon what the particular program is, are very, very upset. And they're not going to be supporting,
Except the NSA doesn't read the polls. And even if they did read the polls, they'd lie about it anyway.
No,
they don't care about the polls.
That's true.
And they're not about to let go of their power easily.
But there's There's an election around the corner, so these politicians, even those who have supported the NSA all along the way, are trying to set things up so that they can go to their constituents and they can say, hey, I propose this legislation that would restrict the NSA, and I honor your privacy, and blah, 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 blah. So they need cover for this election.
And that's the key word, cover. That's why I say I'll believe it when I see it, see it actually being implemented, because I suspect that anything actually coming out of Congress will probably be toothless. That's just my suspicion.
Either toothless or so vague that nobody can accuse them of actually supporting what they adopt.
Yeah, I think that's very likely.
That's standard political procedure, you know.
Sad but true, yeah, unfortunately. Well, we've got about 7 minutes left, actually 5 minutes of real usable time. Let's take a little bit of time to touch on monetary, because that's one of our favorite subjects anyway. The Fed, not surprisingly, Janet Yellen put out mixed signals that the market took a couple different ways, but the bottom line is there's really not going to be any change soon. There's speculation there may be an increase in rates coming this spring, but there's also speculation that there won't be, which is kind of par for the course.
Well, here's what happened. Yellen said, you know, this Bernanke guy that we used to have in charge here, he's no longer in charge. He thought it was a good idea to have actual benchmarks to tell people what we're going to do. You know, like, so if employment goes below 6.5% or inflation goes above 2.3%, then we're going to adjust the insurance area interest rates. She's saying, no, really, let's get rid of these benchmarks. We're going to just, you know, peruse all of the data. We're going to look at everything, you know, economic trends and public expectations and this and that or another thing. So we don't really want you to know exactly what we're going to do when, you know, an exact thing happens and that we, you know, the public knows about. We're just going to look at all the numbers and decide one way or the other whether or not we're going to increase rates. We want to be mysterious.
Which was basically a way of saying we're going to not be guided by what the past chairman did, but we're going to be guided by what the past chairman did.
We're going to, it's a revision of the mystic program.
Yes.
It's going to be the mystic Yellen. You will not know what she's yelling about until she actually decides she wants you to figure out what's going on. And then that they're going to announce that on Friday at 6:30.
Well, I predict the yelling is actually going to come from other sources, and they're going to be yelling at Yellen, but that's for a future discussion.
One of those names is too tempting.
Speaking of things to yell about, U.S. Treasuries are something to yell about. In fact, the markets are kind of down on them right now, and it kind of makes you wonder if that's a sign of things to come.
Well, here's the thing. Maybe a lot of factors involved over the past year or so, the Greek debacle and various other financial circumstances going on. But the Crimea situation has caused all kinds of countries to get very worried about what kind of sanctions, financial sanctions, the U.S. is going to impose on Russia and how that's going to affect world markets. And so has not been noted is that a lot of different countries, Russia, China, Turkey, South Africa, they're all frantically selling U.S. Treasury bonds for a variety of different reasons in order to get back their currency. In other words, to recall the loans, which is what a Treasury bill is anyway, so that they can get back their currency. Now, in fact, we've been talking some time ago, six months or so ago, about various countries, Germany in particular, wanting to reclaim the gold in Fort Knox that has their ownership tag on it. We want the gold. Well, now they're saying we don't trust this Treasury thing. We don't trust the U.S. dollar anymore because you're using all these crazy sanctions anytime you please, and we need protection. And so it's interesting development.
There was a really interesting quote that came out of the Telegraph article that you were drawing from when you pulled this information. It said, this comes from Lars Christensen from Danske Bank. He says, Russia is committing economic suicide. There is a massive corruption scandal in Turkey, and capital outflows from China threaten to have huge ramifications. And now here's the interesting part. If the U.S. dollar were to strengthen drastically at this point, we would go straight into a global recession. Now, that's an interesting thing to make. That's an interesting statement to make.
Surviving meltdown, so to speak.
Yeah, really. Because here we are on the one hand talking about how everybody is selling treasuries like crazy, and now he's talking about the dollar strengthening. I kind of wonder if the wheels are falling off of the logic train.
I don't know. It's It's, you know, financial policy and monetary policy around the world is something that's kept close to the vest for just about every country that's manipulating their currency.
Well, then we'll just have to look at it next week and see what we can figure out. Hey, Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Hey.
Hey, we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution.